This is a Pinball News production.
Thanks very much, folks. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank Mike and Larry and Ron and the rest of the PPM board members for inviting me to come to speak today. I also want to thank you all for your continuing support. I see a number of faces that I saw 2 years ago when I was here, and I've seen the attendance and crowd grow accordingly. So keep it up, folks. Anything and everything you can do to be proselytizers for pinball is great. I've always admired these seminars. I'm going to call this one the open mic session. The subject that I'm dealing with is, on the face of it, somewhat controversial. Some of you folks are going to take issue with some of my observations. Some of you might feel very strongly that I'm making some points that need to be addressed. But that's entirely up to you, and I welcome any reaction that you might have at the end of this. And let's get on with it. Essentially, the subject of what I'm talking about has to do with the increasing loss of the casual player. For those of you who have been into pinball for more than a few years, you may have been able to perceive this or watch it happening. But for decades and decades, almost from its inception, the success of pinball as an economic venture, if you will, has depended largely upon the casual player. The people in this room, myself included, are what I would call engaged pinball players. When we were kids, we'd hop on our bike and ride to the bowling alley just to play pinball, or go to the soda shop just to play pinball. But that's not the way the world really was constructed. Pinball, for most people, was a casual diversion while they were waiting to have their pizza cooked, or waiting for a lane in the bowling alley, or having a casual beer with a friend, whatever it might be. So the concerns that I've raised have to do primarily with the casual player, and the things that have happened in, say, the intervening 50 years that have reduced that audience, and also to some extent had an effect upon people like ourselves who are pinball engaged. I don't want to brag on myself, but I have been playing pinball for 55 years. I've collected them for 35 years, so I feel I speak with some degree of credibility about this issue, and hopefully if any brickbats are coming my way, you'll let me know so I can duck. Okay. Pinball before licensing, when imagination was king. I do have to apologize for the fact that at this point in my life, I read better than I remember. So I will be reading a significant portion of this text when I'm not ad-libbing or making silly comments. You're going to have to indulge me for a couple of minutes. The first 2 or 3 minutes of this presentation are set up. I want to try and provide you with a context in which you'll be able to look at the slides that follow. There are about 150 of them. I hope to get through all of them. The quality of them varies considerably. Some of them I had to pull off the net. Some of them came out of my own collection. And some of them I'm not sure where I got. But let's get started. I think I've restated that a lot of things have happened to pinball in the last half century that have reduced its appeal to the casual player, the audience that traditionally supported it for decades, and in many cases, a portion of the pinball-engaged audience as well. Now, among those negative developments, in my judgment, and this is one person's opinion, were all of the following. The disappearance of traditional locations. That is unarguable. Every corner store, every soda fountain, every mom-and-pop store in the country when I was a kid had these machines. Now it's a mission to find a place where there's a location. The chains, the big box stores, the franchises have moved into all of those places that were traditional locations. Bars have become problematic. A lot of people have gotten out of the bar business because of the liability involved, and even those that have stayed in because of the non-smoking, you get fewer people coming in, staying for shorter periods of time. That's issue number one. Number two is the lack of competitive manufacturers. Coming out of World War II, there was Bally, Chicago Coin, Exhibit Supply, a.k.a. Esco, Genco, Gottlieb, Keeney, United, and Williams. You're going to see examples of all eight of these companies products in this presentation, along with those from Data East, Marvel, NASCO, Premier, Rally, Stern, and Victory. Today, there's only Stern, plus a game so far from Herb Silvers, a game promised so far from Jersey Jack, and one from Gene Cunningham. So the world of pinball has shrunk dramatically. What are some of the other issues, guys? Well, economic belt tightening, less discretionary income, that applies across the board. There's no question about it. It's hard times for everybody, and it's even harder times for pinball. The closing of arcades, which is ironic because arcade owners couldn't convert over from pinball to video games quickly enough, and in so doing cut their own throats, because a pinball experience, a genuine pinball experience, can only be experienced with a real machine. And as the home game versions of things got better and better and better, and there was less interest and less incentive for people to go to arcades, what do you think happened? Arcades closed. And if they had stuck with pinball instead, they might still be with us. But that be that what it may, it's also the growth of cocooning. People do things at home. They don't have the money to go out. They feather their nest. They do things that are inexpensive, more family-oriented, spend money rather than going to the movies. They'll buy a new VCR or all of the sophisticated electronic equipment now available. So that's had an effect on pinball. This is one that's a particular thorn in my side, the reduction in the importance and the number of replays. When I was a kid, you could bang on a machine and sometimes win 10, 12, 15 games with a single game. That, to me, was a real incentive. And boy, did the people that were watching you get excited. And, oh, wow, look at that guy. Man, he's racked up 10 games or he's racked up 15 games. And for some reason, at some point during the development of pinball, somebody decided, well, you know, maybe it was a video game. You know, the video game replays were never an issue there. You just went from one level to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. But there's always been a reward for pinball. At the outset, it was money, or tickets good for money, or tickets good for merchandise. And as I said, look at even the replay games made during the 50s. You could win up to 26 games on a Gottlieb game. And a matter of fact, they made one machine where you could win 26 games on one particular maneuver, a game called Sweet Adeline. Williams had a 48-game reel on it. Could win up to 48 games. And these are not bingo machines. These were amusement pinball machines. Fewer balls per game. I remember back in the 50s, everything was 5 balls. 5 cents, 5 balls. All of a sudden, it's 3 balls. That's interesting. And the price has gone up, you know, how many times since then? I think another thing that's hurt pinball, and particularly hurt a lot of the people that were peripherally involved in pinball, is the fact that we now play for score-only play. When I was younger, particularly with the Gottlieb games, there were usually as many as five routes to special, 5 different separate scoring systems that allowed you to win replays on these games. Now you play for one reason. You play for score, which is fine, but it doesn't give you that ability to target your interest and your particular skills in one of 2, 3, 4, 5 areas. You just play for score. And I think that's diminished pinball, and I think it's diminished its appeal. I also don't think that the multiplayer was a gift to pinball. I personally think that the pinball is a one-to-one relationship between the machine and the person. Gottlieb tried to sell the idea that pinball was, it's more fun to compete. Well, I think pinball is comparative. It's not competitive. And I think when you interrupt that relationship between the player and the game, that you lose something very interesting about pinball. There's a kind of a zen thing that happens, kind of a correspondence between the player and the game. And when you interrupt that with multiple players and people jumping in and jumping out, I think it destroys some of the allure, some of the interest in that particular experience, and one of the things that drives people to play, or used to drive them to play. I've had long discussions with famous designer Wayne Nyans, and we talked about the moldy players. And by his own admission, very, very, very seldom were four players playing on a four-player game. He metered games to see what the incidence of two and three and four players was, and it was dismally disappointing. Yet the distributors bought the line that if you had more players, you'd make more money. Well, maybe so, maybe not. But to me, the single-player five-ball game is still the apex of pinball. One man's opinion.
Two.
Thank you, Dan. I think another thing, this sounds inconsequential, maybe even stupid, but I think the replacement, and I know why they did it, I think the replacement of wood legs with metal legs was a mistake. I think there was a spring in the play, an ability to maneuver the game, a pliability, if you will, which exited with the wood leg. I know it was an economy measure. I know in part it was a security measure, but I think it was a poor choice. I think we suffer from graphic overkill today. I think there's so much graphics and so dense on the play field that in many cases I'm not able to keep my eye on the ball. I cannot find the ball on the play field because there is not one inch of empty space. I also believe that the depth of game rules have made it almost impossible for the newcomer or the casually interested player to become in any way intimately involved with pinball. They're just too damn deep. They're too complicated. People don't know what the objectives are. They don't have the time or the money to stand there and put $40 or $50 into a game to be able to intuit what they're supposed to do. In the old days, you could read a scorecard, go up to a game, and within two or three games, understand what you were doing and enjoy yourself. I see that having fallen away and being a reason for concern. Finally, we have the issue of licensed properties, which is the focus, really, of this presentation. There are 13 reasons that I've given. 12 of them are really, I guess, subjects of another session or discussion, but I'd like to launch in with a review of the effects, good and bad, of licensing. I know that Gary made a very good point the other day when he was in here presenting, and his point about licensing was it allowed you to sell in large numbers to distributors, and that's fine, and I grant him that, and I understand his desire to continue to do that, but ultimately you have to measure the success of his doing business that way with the effect on the player. So it might be fine that the distributor, you know, takes a shine to a Tron or to a come on, Gordon, senior moment, guys.
Transformers,
whatever. I was thinking Jersey Jack's game, and I couldn't.
Wizard of Oz.
But if that gets to the street and it doesn't make it, it doesn't really matter how many games the distributor bought. If they don't earn in their street location for the operator, and they don't resonate with the player, then you know, you got a problem. So while I do acknowledge that there are certain reasons, and I don't have to explain them, you know the allure of licensing and why people do it, because it's a known property and presumably it's something that people have some interest or affection in. But here are my thoughts take them for what you will. Licensing of properties for pinball began in 1975 when Bally bought the license to use elements of the Who's Tommy movie and Wizard. In my opinion, there are at least three potentially negative consequences of today's licensed property approach to pinball design. First is monetary. It increases the manufacturer's cost of doing business, and it reduces the potential profit per game. It may not reduce the total profit, but it reduces his potential profit per game, because each game he's got to pay the licensor a certain amount of money to be able to use that license. Second, those who are disinterested or turned off by the licensed property are unlikely to play, or in the case of distributors, operators, and pinball collectors, unlikely to purchase the game. And if the license original is a flop, so goes the game. Third, and in many ways more important, and this is kind of subtle, and I'm sure there'll be people that disagree mightily with this, but in my judgment, licensed games no longer have an independent identity. Instead, they rely upon reference to and comparison with the license experience. They offer derivative rather than original entertainment diversions. Today, pinball relies almost exclusively on licensed properties. As a result, game development has devolved from let's start with a great design concept and develop an interesting storyline and graphics that reinforce it, to let's find a great licensed property and retrofit a game design around it. It's a big difference. Licensed properties rob pinball designed around them from an independent existence, and they rob players of the opportunity to exercise their imaginations and construct storylines that mirror their individual tastes and fantasies. With licensed games, there's almost nothing left to the interpretation or imagination of the player. In contrast, earlier pinball machines drew heavily upon players' imaginations, often with great success. The focus of this presentation is how clever the pinball makers were prior to licensing in extracting exciting elements from the popular culture of the day and translating them into imaginative pinball themes that echoed the originals, usually without violating any copyrights or trademarks. These pre-licensed games showed imagination on the part of the makers and freed the player's imagination to build upon the encoded storylines of these games with their own fantasy and visions, rather than being force-fed a licensed theme and the strict interpretation of the artwork and play features that a license dictates. Bear in mind that when you get a decent license, there are all sorts of restrictions that apply to how that's used, to the elements of that intellectual property that can be incorporated. There are also lay-ons and demands that are required by the licensor that have to be incorporated one way or another into the machine. So the designer's hands in many ways have been tied, and that too I think is problematic. I'd like to quote from an article on Tim and Charlotte Arnold's Pinball Hall of Fame. This article appeared in the June 2nd calendar section of the Los Angeles Times. While discussing the array of more than 200 games available for play there, writer Jorge Labrador states, "It's the older machines, the ones that aren't based on a movie, TV show, rock star, video game, or comic book, that will catch your curiosity. Games like the sci-fi themed and cheesecake art-laden Centigrade 37, the white hat cowboy and western trope-heavy lawman, and the far too literal pinball, each weave their own narrative in your imagination without relying on voiceovers, brief video clips, and glued-on action figures to do so." That's what he said. With Centigrade 37, the gorgeous retro art sets the scene and lets your mind run wild. Why is that woman frozen, and what sinister force is that other woman running from? In the case of Lawman, who's the sheriff, and what did they do to launch his ruthless pursuit? And with pinball, why is there a giant steel ball rolling around in traffic? These older machines don't tell you part of someone else's story. They get the ball rolling and let you tell your own. It's a throwback to an era when you used your imagination to fill in the blanks. The artwork of games from the pre-license period will help tell our story. Let's begin our journey with the years surrounding World War II. This, as you probably recognize, is the James Montgomery Flagg recruitment poster. I think it was originally developed for World War I, used again in World War II, and is probably the most famous poster ever produced. As war approached, the nation and the pinball manufacturers were preparing for the inevitable. Here we see cadets on the banks of the Hudson at West Point in New York inspiring this beautiful glass, exhibits 1941 Big Parade. I mean, it's almost a direct translation of that formation. As you probably know, from December 7th, 1941, until September 2nd, 1945, the United States was at war. During that time, there was no new pinball production for the duration. Big Parade was made right before pin production ended, and the factory switched over to wartime production. Exhibit Supply and Bally were the big dogs prior to World War II. Big Parade, the glass that you're looking at now, was converted after the war in 1946 to a number of other games, including this one, United's Very Beautiful Riviera. Now, if you take a look, you can kind of see why they did what they did, because the holes drilled in the back box continued to line up. Anyway, during the war, Harry Williams and Lynn Durant had formed United. The company did a large number of conversions before beginning the production of original games with Seabreeze in December 1946, and Riviera was one of their earlier ones. Let's go to another wartime subject. Many of you will recognize Tail Gunner Joe. Tail Gunner Joe McCarthy. McCarthy was kind of a rogue. More than a rogue, he was kind of a sleaze. He was the junior senator from Wisconsin. He falsely claimed to have been a tail gunner during the war. In fact, the shot was taken after the war. But that didn't deter him from using it in his stumping speeches. Anyway, he falsely accused or alleged communism in both the U.S. government and the Army, responsible for the Army-McCarthy hearings, as you probably know, ultimately censured for his recklessness by the Senate and appropriately died of alcoholism at the age of 48. Now, he never inspired a pinball, but the heroics of his claimed military occupation did this beautiful game, Tail Gunner. Built by Victory Games in 1944, Victory was another producer of conversion games during the war, actually from the period 1942 to 1947. Tail Gunner was a conversion of Genko's fairly uninspired 1941 10 spot, shown here. Ooh, wow, ugly. Cool. Ugly. Cool. Why don't we go to a subject that truly was a hero during World War II? The Hornet, who sits very, very close to the PPM storage area. I won't say any more than that. But the U.S. Hornet was a true hero of World War II combat. They were an aircraft carrier. They earned 9 battle stars for service. They successfully recovered the space capsules from Apollo 11 and 12 and their crews. And they're the most haunted ship in the Navy. Currently, they're a museum in Alameda, just minutes from the Pacific Pinball Museum. And here's Williams' tribute to the Hornet and its sister aircraft carriers. Flat top. Now, flat top was a conversion of many, many wartime machines. Excuse me, flat top was converted from many pre-war machines. And I'll give you kind of a rundown on some of them. Pan American was one of them, but also Bally's 1940 Attention and Mascot, Bally's 1941 Silver Skates, Air Force, Mystic, Pursuit, Broadcast, and Crossline. This was often the case where several games would be used, several pre-war games would be used to make one particular model of a wartime game, a wartime conversion. But when our troops weren't fighting, out there fighting our enemies, you might find them here. This is a USO stage door canteen. They were a series of World War II non-alcoholic nightclubs. They were staffed by the stars of stage and screen. They existed in 8 U.S. cities, and there was also one in London and in Paris. The Broadway and the Hollywood stage door canteens were the biggest and the most famous. And here you might recognize Betty Davis, serving up some pastry to an Army airborne trooper. Here's Gottlieb's tribute to the USO and their work, 1945 stage door canteen. It was the first amusement pinball that Gottlieb made after World War II. They made 7,500 of them to meet the pent-up demand of the paucity of, well, the non-existence of new, absolutely new games during the war. And it was a decade, it was many, many decades before a game maker had another run as long as 7,500 units. The central figure in this pretty back glass is very likely Betty Grable, who was kind of the pinup queen of the World War II era. And Stage Door Canteen happened to have been a remake of Gottlieb's earlier 1942 Liberty. Both of those games exist in the PPM collection, and at some point we hope to have them both restored and out and available for play. Let's move on to the post-war era and see how the pinball folks mined the popular culture for topical themes. Certainly sports and baseball in particular was a rich source. Let's start with a blast from the past. This is a shot of Ernie Banks, Hall of Famer, on a baseball card. He was affectionately known as Mr. Cub, shown here on a 54 Bowman Gum card, 94, in his rookie year. He was an all-star selection 11 times, twice voted the National League's most valuable player, first ballot inductee into the Hall of Fame. Just kind of giving you a flavor for the nostalgia of that era. And then jumping forward for a moment to get a benchmark on how the American pastime is treated in the licensing era, Chicago Cubs triple play. Ernie, of course, was Mr. Cub. I guess my feeling is that in an area as rich with potential subject matter as baseball, I have to question why it makes sense to go to a licensing mode. I mean, prior to licensing, the pin makers found hundreds of ways to exploit the national pastime, and this included not just amusement pinballs, but the annual pitch and bats that Williams made every April or every March or April to coincide with the beginning of the baseball season. Let me show you, if I could, examples from six manufacturers who took the more traditional route and simply took things from the popular culture to serve as subjects for their games. This is Exhibit Supplies 1946 fastball. Really pretty back glass. I can't identify the artist. I don't think it's either Parker or Melanton, but it's pretty cool art. This is Williams' 1948 Yanks. It's got the man running unit, the horizontal man running unit in the back box. Excuse me, the vertical man running unit. That was also used again in 1949 in Star Series. Here's the playfield of Yanks. Kind of an unusual piece because there weren't many baseball games, certainly those with running units, that were not pitch and bats, so it's unusual from that standpoint. This is 1952 Williams Slugfest. Really nice diorama in the back, now with a horizontal man unit. And it was interesting. Williams must have had a great deal of protection on this because it was never copied by the other manufacturers. But the man running unit combined with the pitch and bat feature really established and solidified Williams' dynasty in the pitch and bat area, and they're still probably the best games available of that type. Here's the play field for Williams' lucky inning. Notable because it's one of the rare turret shooter games made in that era. There were only a handful of them. Sportsman was the other Williams turret shooter. Genco made Canasta. Gottlieb made Just 21, Selectacard, Bankaball, Buffalo Bill, and the domestically unreleased 1955 two-player Ricochet, shown here. This is a very interesting piece. Apparently what happened was a few sample models of the game were made, released to the domestic market, put on test locations, and by that time the interest in that turret shooter mechanism had faded, so it failed on location, but anecdotally, it's been said that it was distributed outside the U.S. There have been a couple of sightings. Supposedly, there's an existing game in Canada, but it's a real rare beast. Note the massive cabinet. Many of you have probably never seen a Gottlieb 50s multiplayer, but the things were absolutely huge. They had picnic table legs and what we called a belly bar in the front. And they weighed about, I don't know, over 300 pounds, I believe. Interesting pieces. But returning to baseball and how it was treated before licensing, here's United's 1949 pitch hitter. I love the use in that era of the purple, and I'd say parenthetically that if you're doing a restoration on a back glass with that particular purple, particularly the Gottlieb purple, very, very difficult to match. Wade, I'm sure you've had that experience. Extremely hard to match it. This is Chicago Coin's play ball. Interesting piece. Even in the 50s, this was run on dime play. It had no bats or flippers and a very simple back glass, but yet another evidence of how things from the popular culture were simply adapted and made good subjects. Here's Hits and Runs by Genco. I'm not sure how well you can see this, but these little folks here that indicate the extra special when lit absolutely echo the little figures on Gottlieb's Happy Days that indicate the special lanes, for those that are familiar with those two games. This is Gottlieb's 1951 Bush League, very likely a single prototype. It's interesting for a number of reasons. One, because it was never line produced, and this indeed may be the only surviving example. And two, because it's the only baseball game of that era, pitch and bat, that actually had rollovers on the play field. I think the current owner of this is our friend David Silverman. He got it from John Papa, who is a coin-op dealer in Mohawk, New York. This is Gottlieb's 1952 hit and run. Again, the Gottlieb girls engaged not in softball because that's an overhand pitch being thrown. So Parker went the whole route. He decided he was going to feminize the players, and that's what we got. This is Big Hit from Chicago Coin. Chicago Coin made quite a few games in the 50s. The play field on this game is identical to their earlier Whiz Kids, which was a basketball theme. So they just changed the sports theme and had two pretty viable games. I remember playing this on the boardwalk in Ocean City, New Jersey when I was a kid. And the operator, for some reason, managed to not lock the back door. So I played long and I played free. This is Gottlieb's wonderful Grand Slam. The Parker artwork on this is among his best. It's filled with visual puns. There's the bullpen with the bull. Interesting that he had to acknowledge the emerging media of TV down here in the corner. It was so notable that at that time it added a little interest and spice to it. This is the play field. Great fun game. Larry and some of the other folks in the audience own it and have played it, and among the best players. This is Gottlieb's slugging champ for 1955. The true slugging champ of 1955 was the New York baseball Giants Hall of Famer Willie Mays. True to form, we would not expect to see an African American on a back glass at this time, despite the fact that he should have been the one receiving the accolades. Led the majors with a .354 batting average and a .667 slugging average that year, but we have some nameless white guy there. Notice that the pennants are the cities, not the teams. Again, acknowledging the reference, but not being specific as to get into a situation. Did you have something to say, Larry? Yeah, beautiful. You bet. Never miss a chance. And then finally, in the area of baseball as a subject, Gottlieb returns in 72 with Grand Slam, using that title for the second time. I want to take a look now quickly at boxing. Now, there was another area that where there was high interest, particularly in the 40s, but carrying into the 50s. There were some great fights that took place in the 50s. And the manufacturers did quite a bit with boxing. This is clearly not the 50s. That's the Ollie Frazier fight. But to get us started in the category, this is what they did with licensing. Ali, 1980. another example of a licensed property in an area that really didn't require one to do well. As you probably all know, Ali started his career as gold medal winner in the 1960 Olympics, fighting under his birth name Cassius Clay. This is Gottlieb's 1940 champ, a game that was so successful that the very next year, 1941, they remade it and changed nothing except the title, and it became the new champ. Why so simple? This is 1941 Exhibit Supply Knockout, 9 years before Gottlieb's Classic. I apologize for the quality of the slides. If you could see it in person, the colors are absolutely magnificent. And here's our much-beloved Knockout, another Roy Parker classic. It's art in the miniature boxing ring on the playfield, of course, make it a highly collectible and desirable piece, and I hope you've had a chance to play it on the floor of the exhibit. Another Gottlieb effort, Madison Square Gardens. Note the S, not Madison Square Garden, Madison Square Gardens. So we stay out of trouble with the owners of Madison Square Gardens. Madison Square Garden, the one depicted here, was built in 1925. It was actually the third Madison Square Garden, and it closed in 1968. It was located on 8th Avenue in Manhattan between 49th and 50th Street. And for decades, many of the greatest prize fights took place there and at St. Nicholas Arena, also in the borough of Manhattan. This is the site where Marilyn Monroe sang her infamous happy birthday to John Kennedy. And that was in May of 62, shortly before her passing. The backlit animation that you can see of the players is really a hoot. It's not quite as engaging as the animated boxing ring on Knockout, but it's still pretty cool. Somebody needs to reproduce those long plastics on either side of the game. They're always bacon when you find one. This is how Chicago Coin treated boxing. This is punchy. And it's likely Parker art. And when he worked for people other than Gottlieb, he kind of had to do things that were not quite as much fun or as interesting as the Gottlieb stuff, because he was just prescribed from using the same style. It was okay for him to work for them, but he could not use the identical style to what he used when he was working for Gottlieb. This is a great game, Gottlieb's World Champ from 1957. I think many of you are familiar with it. It was one of the many great playing Gottlieb multiple special gobble hole games, others being Wishing Well, Frontiersman, Sweet Adeline, Gypsy Queen, Rainbow, Harbor Lights, Classy Bowler, Derby Day, and so many others. World Champ was also, and Larry can confirm this, was one of three known Gottlieb wood rails that were also made as proto-attaball games before the introduction of True Attaball and Flipper. The others were Classy Bowler and Dancing Dolls. And they were done for the areas that prescribed giving of anything, including a replay, as an award. And instead of having a score or a game reel that went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it would say balls next to it, and it would be 5, 10, 15, 20. Yeah, Larry.
0 through 26 on the credit wheel, it would read 5 through 135 balls for each game.
And as soon as the fifth ball would play, if you had replays on the game, there'd be a short pause, and then a new game would begin. And there was no replay button on the front, so that kept the local police guessing. But we've discovered three games that they did this on. There may be others, but when querying Wayne Nyans, he had no knowledge of it. Said he didn't. This is the playfield of World Champ, It harks back to one of the points I made earlier in the presentation. You'll note that that gobble hole could be lit for up to 10 games. And if you were skillful enough to light it for 10 games on ball three or ball four, you could drop it for another 10 and then drop it for another 10, and all of a sudden you maxed out the reel at 26. They don't make that kind of excitement in today's games, I'm sorry to say, but that's life. This is Golden Gloves. That was Williams' attempt at a boxing game of that era. Pretty successful game. Remember playing it as a kid. Here's Palooka, a later Williams effort. Now, this, of course, was based on Ham Fisher's long-running comic strip about a mild-mannered heavyweight champion boxer that ran in syndication from 1930 to 1984. To feature Joe Palooka himself here appearing in his comic book number one, and his manager, Nobby Walsh, and Joe's overweight sidekick, blacksmith Humphrey Pennyworth, who lived in a mobile home powered by his bicycle. And here we see Humphrey. One final example in the pre-licensing boxing category, belly knockout. Let's take a few minutes now to see how pins drew on world events for game themes in the pre-licensing era. This is a coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in 1953. This, on the other hand, is late 1952, Gottlieb coronation. Now, this queen has the scepter and the crown that Queen Elizabeth II had, but she's Miss America competing on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. A fellow named Charlie Lang, who was a good friend of Steve Young's, managed to find the identical coronation that he had played in high school and purchased it and put it into his collection, which is kind of a neat thing. This is the Soviet Sputnik, launched in late 1957. The race for space was underway. And early in 1958, here comes Williams with satellite. Another area that the manufacturers mined that derived from the popular culture was in the area of Olympics. This is St. Moritz. Ironically, there was an Olympic game held there in 28 and again in 48, and this game happens to be 38. But I have a feeling it was probably an homage to the earlier game. This is Williams' 1952 Olympics. Interesting piece because it was one of just four Williams games from the 50s where Leroy Parker did the artwork. The other three were Perky, Majorettes, and Multiplayer Funhouse, which is rarely seen game, but a whole heck of a lot of fun to play if you ever see it. Here's a rare piece, Williams 1956, Red, White, and Blue. This game is owned by Shea Group owner Shea Assad, and it's a patriotic salute to America's athletes of the 1958-56 Winter Games, which took place in Italy. And finally, Gottlieb's 1962 Olympics. Pinball manufacturers also did a lot with world fairs and exhibitions, whatever. Anyway, this is emblematic of the St. Louis 1904 Exposition. It's the fair that provided the storyline for Meet Me in St. Louis, which, of course, was a 1944 romantic musical from MGM that tells the story of an American family living in St. Louis at the time of the Louisiana Purchase Exposition World's Fair, which was the full name of that fair. Starred Judy Garland, was directed by Vincent Minnelli, who later married her and fathered Liza. Here's a poster from the Canadian Pacific Railroad for the Chicago World's Fair of 1933. And there's 1933 Rockola World's Fair Jigsaw. Imagine my surprise. Here's a close-up of the completed puzzle section. And many of you have probably seen this game and maybe even played it. It's in the back of the hall, and it's from the collection of Dan Miller, who's one of the board members of PPM. The other two games that are always mentioned at about the same time as this are Rockola's World Series, and Rockola's Army and Navy, all three of which Dan owns. And I believe all three are on display, are they not, Larry?
Yes.
Yeah. Great games of the absolute mechanical era. Incredible what was accomplished at that point in time.
Work well too.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, amazing.
They sure do. Let's move to the 1939 New York World's Fair. You can see here the Trilon and Perisphere, which was kind of the emblem or the recurrent symbol of that fair. And here's what Keeney did with that, up and up. Really kind of pretty. Incidentally, the parachute jump ride, which was one of the major attractions at this World's Fair, later ended up in Coney Island, where it stayed for decades and amused millions in New York City. New York's World Fair spawned a lot of related pop cultural items, and this is not strictly pinball, but I thought it might be interesting for you. Fair ran from 39 and ran through 39 and 40, and here was one of the things that it spawned: New York World's Fair comic books. It was a 39 issue and a 1940 issue. It was the first comic book that was sold for 15 cents. It had 96 pages in it, both issues, the first and the second. And after the fair ended, it became World's Finest Comics. The lead story was always a Batman story. And he also appeared in his own comic and as the lead story in Detective Comics. Another major attraction of the fair was Billy Rose's Aquacade. Billy Rose's Aquacade began at the Great Lakes Exposition of 1937 and moved to the World's Fair in 39. A version also appeared at the 1940 San Francisco Golden Gate Exhibition. So it was absolutely the most successful production of the 39 New York World's Fair. It was very interesting because it featured three of the greatest swimmers in American history, Johnny Weissmuller, Buster Crabbe, and Esther Williams. Weissmuller had won 5 Olympic golds and appeared in 12 Tarzan movies. Esther Williams had been scheduled to compete in the canceled 1940 Olympics but appeared in more than a dozen films. And Buster Crabbe, who was an Olympic gold medal winner in swimming, and grew up in Oakland in a boarding house. He also had the distinction of being the only person to play Tarzan, Flash Gordon, and Buck Rogers, who were the three comic strip heroes of the 1930s. Pretty amazing. And coattailing on that, Aquacade, 1949, from United. Let's move to another fair in another city. The 1939 San Francisco World Fair. Again, it ran 39 and 40, held on what is now Treasure Island. Celebrated the opening of the Golden Gate and the Bay Bridges. And it's memorialized in Skyrocket. This is a game that Michael owns, Michael Sheese. I think it appeared, was it at last year's expo, Michael?
It was here.
Anyway, it's a beautiful back glass, and you can see echoes precisely the location of the fair. Move for a moment on to Canada, our northern neighbor. Excuse me, missed the slide. This is the 1964 New York World's Fair, also held in Flushing Meadow in Queens, just like the 39. And this is Gottlieb's 1964 World Fair.
What a game.
Moving to Canada, the Expo of 1967 happened to have been the 20th century's most successful expo. They had 50 million visitors, which was a record, and 569,000 on day 3, which was also a record. And here's what the pinball manufacturers did, 1969 Expo by Williams. Let's move on to the sport of kings, the spectacle of horse racing. This, of course, is a shot of the Kentucky Derby, run 126 times every year since 1875. Here's Hay Burners from 1951 by Williams. They used a unique mechanized horse race back box, and this initial effort was copied 3 months later by United with County Fair. Williams made their own army of clones using this same mechanism. One of the games was jalopy, in which case it was cars racing rather than the horses. Sea jockey, where they had seahorses racing. And then spark plugs, nags, handicap, Daffy Derby, all of which were employed that same mechanical track. And here's the unusual horse feathers, which was a two-player console. So those who say that Duet and Super Jumbo were the first multiplayers, not so. In fact, even horse feathers Chicago Coin made a similar piece to this back in 51, and that was called Derby. And 18 years prior to that, in 1933, Bally made a game called Jack and Jill, which was also a two-player, but it was nothing more than two single games melded together with shooters right and left. So there have been multiplayer games around for a long time, but they've taken different guises. What I was about to say is that all of these horse race games were descendants of gambling pieces. This is Baker's Pacers from 1940. Other entries were Pace's Races and Bally's Ray's Track, the Ray being Ray Maloney. Beautiful console games, if you ever see one. They're fun to play and pretty to look at. In a more traditional vein, this is a backlash from Gottlieb's 1954 Jockey Club. Gottlieb, for a long period of time, from the end of World War II until this game was produced, avoided horse race themes. And the reason being that horse races were the typical theme for most one-ball games, which were gambling pieces. Almost every one-ball was a horse race game. And Gottlieb was very interested in distancing himself from the gambling element in the coin-op industry. By doing so, he alienated a lot of his competitors, who were also, in many cases, friends. But he saw the handwriting on the wall, and I think wisely got out before the heat got too intense. So this was his first horse race themed game in many, many years. Followed it with Derby Day in 1956, another really fun game, one of those gobble hole multiple special games. This is Williams' 1958 Turf Champ, where they put the horses in the horse race on the play field. And Williams later in 72 did Winter, where they actually put the running unit beneath clear plexi. So many variations on a theme, but all of them coming out of the generic horse racing area. This is race time. This was a multiplayer Gottlieb game. Very, very pretty play field. Equally pretty play field on 61 photo finish. And photo finish, incidentally, was the last Gottlieb single player with a partial run made in wood rail cabinets. And then finally, we come to 67 and Derby Day by Williams, when they returned to the tried and true chain-operated back box horse race animation. Let me go to another area. As television replaced radio in the early 50s as the home entertainment of choice, the game makers worked this fertile area like champs. For those of you who are not old enough to remember, this is a test pattern from early television. In the early days of TV, frequently a station or a network would only be on air for 3 or 4 hours a day, and the rest of the time, all you had to look at was this test pattern. Now, of course, you've got a million and two options to choose from, but this is where we... Huh? And, of course, there were only three channels and no remotes, so you had to get up and turn the dial. As a point of reference, here's a take on today's licensing using a television theme. 2007 Stern Wheel of Fortune. Got Vanna White, Pat Sajak. Doesn't leave a whole lot to the imagination. And photography has replaced silkscreen illustration. Thank you. Here's how they used to do it. Remember What's My Line, the old panel show? Well, it was Dorothy Kilgallen, or our host, of course, was John Charles Daly. Dorothy Kilgallen, who wrote a syndicated column called Voice of Broadway. She was the only reporter ever to interview Jack Ruby and died under suspicious circumstances, which were never really resolved. The next in line is Steve Allen. He was the first host of The Tonight Show, some of you might remember. He wrote more than 14,000 songs. Next to him is Arlene Francis, who was an actress and radio talk show host. Next to her, Bennett Cerf, the publisher and co-founder of Random House. And what did Dee Gottlieb do with this? Watch My Line. There they are, up in the right-hand corner. And, of course, the title jokingly refers to the habit of celebrities stepping on each other's lines. So it was quite interestingly conceived. Interesting piece from another perspective. It was the nearest thing that Gottlieb ever made to a bingo. Although it had no advancing odds or multi-coin features, there was nothing on that play field but 15 holes. Let's move to another area of early TV. This is Jack Barry, and in the isolation booth, the now infamous Charles Van Doren and his opponent, Herbert Stempel. Many of you probably have read or recall that the cheating that went on this show caused the demise of the television quiz shows of the day. The contestants were given the answers before the contest took place, and they had determined that they were going to have Charles Van Doren, who was a much more interesting and gallant character, beat Mr. Stempel, and Stempel got his nose out of joint, and he took his story to the district attorney in New York, and that was the end of it. But it didn't deter the pinball makers, because here's 20 grand from Williams, 1952. This game is also a game in the PPM collection. I don't think it's been restored yet, but it's an interesting piece. It had a couple of interesting features. It had a lot of trap holes on it, and one of the things you could do in those trap holes was spell out the word 20, and if you did, you won 20 games. Again, multiple replays, multiple satisfactions. It also had an interesting feature called the auto flip. They were flippers that were mounted behind trap holes, and when the ball went into the trap hole, pushed a little rod down, and the flipper flipped automatically. It was kind of a cool feature. Not much player control, but a lot of wow factor. Here are friends Jack Webb and Ben Alexander from Dragnet. I'm sure most, if not all of you, remember it or have seen it in reruns or syndication. Dragnet had been frequently parodied. Mad Comics did a comic strip called Dragged Net. Comedian Stan Freeberg cut a record called St. George and the Dragonette. And, of course, Dee Gottlieb, as shown in this backlash, did Dragonette. And there's at least one, maybe two on the floor, Larry?
We have Four Bells.
Four Bells, yeah. Four Bells was the B version of Dragonette, the identical play field and identical back box configuration, but different graphics. There's also the chance that Dragonette was inspired by a singer of the time, Jessica Dragonette. And Jessica Dragonette at the time was a real radio star. She was known as the Star of Stars or the Sweetheart of the Air. She's got her own star on the Hollywood Walk of Stars. And she was a frequent performer at coin machine events. So the coin people knew about her, and that might have been their out in case anybody came after them. Oh, no, this is about Jessica. Here's a wonderful shot of Lucy at the Vitamita Vegemin. I'm sure you remember that episode. Dragnet and I Love Lucy were the two hottest shows of the 53-54 TV season. And here's what Gottlieb did with Lovely Lucy. And there's Lucy, and there's Ricky's Cuban Band. Very interesting piece. There's one on the floor out there. I encourage you to play it. It's notable because it's one of very few Gottlieb games from that era that had an asymmetric play field, and that's because of the position of the drop holes. I think the only other Gottlieb that I can recall that has an asymmetric play field in that era was Quintet, which had a kicking rubber only on one side above the flippers. Here we see, I forgot to show you this. This is the asymmetric play field. Here we see Fess Parker and his admiring following of youngsters in their coonskin caps. Everybody remembers his role in the 1955 six-part action saga for Walt Disney. Ironically, he later also played Daniel Boone. He owned a winery here in California and sadly passed away recently. Couldn't do Davy Crockett, but they sure could do Frontiersman. And this game was a killer game. It was, again one of those multiple special drop hole games. It also had a carryover feature where you could advance the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 up the side. Every time you aligned A, B, C, and D, it moved the arrow. And when you got up to 5, you, I think, won 5 replays. Very, very interesting piece. Here was a more modern attempt at leveraging an existing property in the popular culture. Here we see the cast of Hee-Haw. And here we see Hee-Haw by 73 Chicago Coin. Of course, since Hee-Haw is not something you can protect, they could pretty much run wild with that. But again, you know, in the non-licensing area, they used something that was evocative of something in the culture and then let you kind of let your imagination run wild.
Well, it looks like they were wild.
The manufacturers also pulled from the stage and screen. I mean, here are the drama masks of tragedy and comedy. Sometimes they would pursue theatrical themes in kind of a general sense, as they did here with Gottlieb's 1952 Four Stars. Except for the graphics, this game was identical to Gottlieb's quartet of 4 months earlier. They made 1,400 quartets and 950 Four Stars. And the combination of the two made it the 12th best-selling Gottlieb game during the Golden Age, slightly more than Skill Pool and slightly less than Bowling Champ. So when Gottlieb had a durable format, they tended to reuse it. Four stars, as you might imagine. If you looked at the play field, you'd find 4 pop bumpers, 4 gobble holes, and 4 flippers. Unusual placement because typically Gottlieb games of that era with 4 flippers would have 2 at the base and 2 at midfield. This was a notable exception. A couple others might be Daisy May and the twin of this quartet, and Pinwheel was another one where there was an unusual placement of 4 flippers all at the bottom of the game. This is Williams' attempt at 4 stars. Yeah, not bad. But More often than not, they drew on very specific properties. Here we see the cast of Showboat. Showboat was based on the 1946 Broadway revival and 51 film of Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein's musical, which was in turn based on Edna Ferber's 1926 novel, which in turn was based on the life of the Cotton Blossom, a Mississippi riverboat, that had shows continuously from 1880 to 1927. Here's how the manufacturers handled Showboat. Chicago Coin, 1941. United, 1949. Genco, 1957. And here in a movie still, you're going to see a very young Ron Howard and Glenn Ford in the 1963 film The Courtship of Eddie's Father. Exhibit Supply, which went toes up in 1951 after having been a major factor prior to the war, also did kind of a takeoff on Showboat, although they didn't give it the name Showboat. the graphics were certainly showboat-esque. This is their exhibit with a paddle wheel in the back from 48. And Swanee, again, with the Swanee Bell out there in the river from 49. Even ballet was exploited, believe it or not, by the pinball makers. This is a still from the English movie The Red Shoes. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think it was based on a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. Yeah. Ballet did Ballerina in 1948. You'll notice that the theme and the red shoes remain intact, but it took United in 49 to just take the whole thing. So believe it or not, you'll find ballerinas on pinball glasses at some point in time. This is the last game that that United made as a flipper game. After that, they concentrated their efforts on bingos and shuffles and rifle alleys. But they had a nice run. As I said, this was 1949. This game is also in the PPM collection. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Literature and the movies also provided game makers with inspirational themes. Here we see the Queen of Hearts and Alice from Disney's animated feature, Alice in Wonderland. Based, of course, on Lewis Carroll's work from 1865, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and later Through the Looking Glass. It was the 13th in the Disney animated classic series that started in 37. With Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Here we see Alice, as conceived by David Gottlieb and Company, 1948, Alice in Wonderland. This was the seventh and last game in the so-called fairy tale series, which began with Flipper about a year and a half earlier. I think David Gottlieb was a sly fox. He was coming out of an era when people felt that pinball was evil, pinball was gambling, and of course once the flipper was introduced, the element of skill was introduced. So what could be more benign than children's fairy tales? And that's exactly what he did. Humpty Dumpty, Lady Robin Hood, Cinderella, Jack and Jill, Old King Cole, Alibaba, and finally Alice in Wonderland. All seven of these games are in the collection of the PPM. At some point in the future, we hope to see them all set up sequentially so you can walk down and see the play evolution. There's not a whole lot of evolution that goes on in those seven games. The play board reveals itself quickly as being of pre-flipper design, with the flippers being an obvious add-on, but it didn't take the manufacturers long to realize that the flipper was the ultimate targeting device. So you have to take them for what they are. They have six flippers on each of them, three on each side. They're linked together, so you don't get the kind of action you would get if they had been independently wired. But they're interesting historical pieces. This is one of my favorite glasses, George Millenton's 1955 Wonderland for Williams. Absolutely spectacular, absolutely derivative of the Disney characters, a terrific playing game, and again, there's one of these in the collection that ultimately will be restored and available for play. Yes, I was about to say that. You took the words out of my mouth. This has been translated many times up by muralist Ed Castle. If you'd raise your hand, Ed, and be recognized. And I would say not the only mural that Ed has done. He's done several for the mural collection. And if you haven't seen them all, you owe it to yourself to spend some time with them. The other artists that have been kind enough to contribute are Dan Fonts and Eric Kaz. And we hope and encourage other people with those kinds of incredible talents to contribute as well. This in the back glass from United's Manhattan. are probably my two favorite, and this is kind of a crackerjack extra. It doesn't have too much to do with my theme, but I just wanted to show it because it's so pretty. I love the sense of purple, the sense of movement, the capturing of the skyline of 1948 Manhattan. It was the last United game, non-bingo, without flippers. It was frequently retrofitted by operators with flippers to keep it online for a little bit longer, give it some extra life. And I played this game retrofitted with flippers as late as 1957 in Beach Haven, New Jersey, so it had quite a life. This is the Queen of Hearts back glass. Any of you that are familiar with the game, and there's one on the floor out there, will notice that the back glass here, the background of the back glass is blue rather than green. Clearly this was a test game. I don't know how many of them were made, but I was lucky enough to find a photograph of this one and thought it would be interesting for those who know the game to know that there were some test versions that looked a little bit different. It was Wayne Nyan's favorite game, the man who designed it. It happens to be my favorite game. It happens to be the favorite game of Sam Harvey, a very large collector, and beloved by a lot of other wood rail collectors. It was Gottlieb's first gobble hole game, and it went on to do very, very well on the streets, later copied by its near cousin, Poker Face. There are plenty of chorus girls featured on pinball machines, but this may have been the inspiration and the granddaddy of them all. Whoop! That's the playfield of Queen of Hearts. Kind of risque. You see the king and the queen playing strip poker, which was pretty hot stuff for that era. These are the Rockettes from Radio City. And this is what Gottlieb did with them. Now, how they got away with this one, I don't quite know. I really don't. But it's interesting. I love the points being scored on the spring of the jack-in-the-box. And, of course, he's leering as all the stupid males on Roy Parker games tend to do. Another venture into pulling from movie archives. This is Jimmy Stewart, of course, in Harvey, a film based on Mary Chase's play of the same name. It's about a man whose best friend is a puka named Harvey who takes the form of a 6 foot, 3 1/2 inch tall rabbit. And, true to form, Williams picks up on it in the game Harvey. You can see the rabbit reference back there on the marquee to the right. Here's another movie convention that the makers did some work with. This is, of course, a marquee for a double feature with Dracula and Bride of Frankenstein, 1931 Todd Browning's Dracula starring Bela Lugosi and Bride of Frankenstein with Boris Karloff and Elsa Lanchester. Double feature, what do you do with that? Well, double feature. Now, this looks more like a burlesque show, which remained a strong form of entertainment well into the 50s. The Billboard Trade Magazine, which you're probably familiar with, at that time covered about 40 different industries, one of them being burlesque, and they had a section on burlesque right through the last issue of 1955, which is kind of interesting. Prominent performers also played a major role in providing themes for pinball machines in the pre-licensing days. Here's Al Jolson appearing in blackface, as he frequently did. In his heyday, he was dubbed the world's greatest performer. He was the highest paid entertainer of the 1930s. He starred in the first full-length talkie, The Jazz Singer, in 1927. He was the first star to entertain troops overseas. And although he often performed in blackface, he was a very, very strong advocate and proponent for black performers, probably did as much for early black performers as anybody in the industry. We see him here on Minstrel Man. Could be none other than Jolson. Ironically, if you look at the back glass, it appears as though his partner on the back glass of this game is the youthful Lena Horne. Here's the cast of Guys and Dolls, 1955 musical, starring Marlon Brando, Gene Simmons, Frank Sinatra, and Vivian Blaine. was based on the earlier Broadway musical by Frank Lesser, which in turn was based on a couple of Damon Runyon tales. Here's what Gottlieb did with it. This is the playfield of Guys and Dolls. Often and incorrectly referred to, even in the trade press, as Guys and Dolls. Indeed, the name was Guys Dolls for obvious reasons. It had a healthy production run of about 1,500 pieces, and it was a daring experiment with a row of kicking posts rather than the traditional flippers. Sadly, it failed on the street. I owned several of them at various times, and one of them that I had in the collection was last operated on pennies, which kind of bespeaks the reception that it received in many quarters. It's a game that might have succeeded admirably if the solenoids powering the kick-up post had been about three times as strong as they were, but it was virtually impossible to get a ball to the top of that game. Yes, Larry?
Wayne said one of the problems with those pop-up posts,
yeah,
was that the
plastic
kept shattering.
Yeah, that too.
When it hit the end of its stroke.
That too. Absolutely. Yeah, it was, unfortunately, it was riddled with difficulties. I'm going to have to move a little more quickly. Ron has given me the 10-minute sign, so you'll have to excuse me if I rush a bit. This game and Watch My Line were the only two flipperless games that Gottlieb ever made during that era. I'm going to skip through the next couple of slides because they're not that relevant. I'm going to go to Mae West, who invented the character, in fact, wrote the play Diamond Lil. It was written by her in 1928. She performed it as late as 1951. And during 1935, only William Randolph Hearst earned more money than she did. Diamond Lil, there it is. Notice that Gottlieb changed the spelling of Lil to L-I-L-L. It's been rumored that the gentleman in the bowler with the cigar is actually a caricature of David Gottlieb. Whether or not that's true, I really can't tell you. Interesting feature on Diamond Lil was the horseshoe runaround. As you advanced that feature, these lights would come on. It had a brilliant flash and a track mode. The horseshoe runaround allowed you to flip back and forth through it if you learned how to play that game skillfully. That's kind of an aside. Twin bills were another earmark of the period, and not surprisingly, Gottlieb made a twin bill. I've often wondered if this wasn't an attempt earlier than the actual two players to incorporate two-player action into a single-player game, but whatever the case, it's a very interesting game. There's one on the floor. You can win on red, you can win on green, you can win on both. The 10,000 unit steps both of the 100,000 units, and it can really be a lot of fun to play. If you haven't, I recommend it to you. Here we see Rex Harrison and Julie Andrews from My Fair Lady. Hugely successful play based on George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, ran 2,717 performances on Broadway. And here is the homage to it by Gottlieb, Fair Lady, from 1956. Gottlieb reprised this game in every regard except for the graphics just a short time later. Actually, this game was a reprise of Sea Bells, which was a game made earlier with the same play features. This is Mayfair, another reference to My Fair Lady. You can see on the marquee of the theater behind the elegantly dressed ladies, My Fair Lady, 1966 by Gottlieb. Here we see Kim Novak and William Holden on a poster for the Technicolor film Picnic. Won two Academy Awards, made a star of Kim Novak, and here's what Gottlieb did with it. A multiplayer, two-player game. It's interesting in that it was the only wood rail multiplayer Gottlieb ever made that had any kind of a feature that you could win a replay on except for score. So in my judgment, that's one of the reasons the multiplayers from that era fared poorly. You could only win one way rather than three, four, or five. Here's Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis in the film The Viking. Here's the 1960 backlash of The Viking by Williams. The industry also borrowed liberally from the music and recording industry. I'll show you a few examples pretty quickly. Here's Dinah Shore, who did probably the most popular version of Buttons and Bows. In those days, the song was more important than the artist. You would have a song that sometimes as many as 5 or 6 or maybe even 10 artists would record. They'd all chart at the same time. And the cult of the artist had not yet emerged. Here's Gottlieb's Button and Bows, based on that song. Buttons and Bows actually came from the movie The Pale Face, which starred Bob Hope and Jane Russell. And apropos of what I was saying about multiple entertainers doing the same song, for example, in 1949 alone, all the following people did Ghost Riders in the Sky: Vaughn Monroe, Frankie Lane, Burl Ives, Peggy Lee, Spike Jones, Gene Autry, Bing Crosby, Sons of the Pioneers. All together have been over 50 people who recorded that song in the last 50 years. You've seen Buttons and Bows. I'm going to move quickly to, this is Liberty Records, Billy Ward is Domino's recording of Stardust, absolutely fabulous and enduring song. Here's 1948, United Stardust. This was an oddball song. It was kind of a novelty record. Civilization, subtitle Bongo, 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 I Don't Want to Leave the Congo. And the most famous version of this was done by the Andrews Sisters and Danny Kaye and incorporated into a pinball machine with only a slight amount of disguise by Nasco's Bingo Bango, which was a conversion of Gottlieb's Just 21. Nasco was an acronym for Nate Schneller out of Philadelphia, who did a number of conversions during the war. This is a particularly late and probably the last example of a conversion from that company. This is a Mercury recording of Caravan by Ralph Martiri and his orchestra, Williams Caravan, just about the same time that that was among the top 50s. Here's a recording by the Ames Brothers of Ragmop. It was a 1950 hit recording. Ed Ames went on to be a successful singer and actor, including playing Daniel Boone's sidekick Mingo on the popular Daniel Boone series. And many of you remember his tomahawk throwing annex on Johnny Carson, which prompted the line Frontier Briss. Here's Ragmop. Kind of interesting. You got big band influence here, and yet you got the jitterbug going on there because nobody really knew what was going on in music in those days. So they vamped. Here's the playfield of Ragmop. Real interesting. The typical Williams asymmetric, goofy but fun recovery shooter here, but those awful impulse flippers. That's first game that I considered buying. It sat in the bedroom of a good friend of mine when I was in grade school, but I ultimately passed and bought an Army Navy. Hot Diggity by Perry Como, very, very popular song of its time. And here's Williams Hot Diggity from just about the same time. You could win by completing waltz, tango, polka, or on score. There's Ed Ames and his brothers. And here's Quartet from D. Gottlieb in 1952. Here's the cast of your hit parade. Russell Ames, Dorothy Collins, Giselle McKenzie, and Snooky Lanson. For those of you who don't know or remember, Hit Parade was a popular American radio and later television music program. It was presented each week on TV, lavish productions of the 7 top pop songs of the time. It was sponsored by American Tobacco's Lucky Strike cigarettes, and Hit Parade, interestingly enough, spawned lots of pop culture memorabilia and products, including Hit Parade cigarettes. which was a dismal failure. It was introduced by American Tobacco to try and catch up with R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris, who had Winston and Marlboro, and these guys had Lucky Strike and Pall Mall, so they figured they didn't really have to worry. You know, they had the two largest selling brands, but they didn't have a filter, and this attempt failed. There were also Hit Parade jukeboxes. This is a Chicago coin Hit Parade jukebox released in 51, played 10 selections, and it was descended from the Wurlitzer line of countertops, which played 78s. And between 37 and 42, Wurlitzer made five of them, the 41, 51, 61, 71, and 81. I'm going to try and draw this to a conclusion pretty quickly. One further piece, Hit Parader magazine. This is interesting. It began in 42. It's still published today. It was nothing more than the lyrics of popular songs. We see Elvis and Dolores Hart on the cover. She starred with him in Lovin' You, King Creole, and starred in Where the Boys Are. She later became a nun, but remained a voting member of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the only nun to be an Oscar voting member. Kind of interesting. And here's Hit Parade, At Long Last, by Marvel. It was an interesting piece. I believe it was the last game they made. It was available in two forms, both with push shoots. One of them took a nickel. The other one took up to four nickels. And the more nickels you played at the time, the lower the score you needed to earn replays. There was one of these in the collection, which is yet to be restored. They also pulled from comics, magazines, and more. Here's Batman and Batman comic number 11, created, of course, by Bob Kane. Here's how they do it with licensing today. It's from Warner Brothers, 1989. Michael Keaton is Batman. Kim Basinger is the love interest. And, of course, Jack Nicholson is the Joker. This is the 10th anniversary issue of Superman, where they retell the origin of Superman. Well, here's how Rally, which was a Nice-based manufacturer in France, incorporated Superman into their game in the pre-licensing era. Here's Daisy May and Little Abner from Al Capp's Little Abner. That strip ran from 1934 to 1977. And there are a number of visual references to it in Pinball of the Era. Here's Harvest Moon with a typical dog patch type hoedown or barn dance. And here's the more explicit Daisy May. Notice that they changed the spelling of May from M-A-E to M-A-Y with all the sexual innuendo intended, and also to protect themselves from possible repercussions from Mr. Cap. Here's Elsie Seeger's Popeye. He started out in Thimble Theater, a comic strip from 1929. Reprints continue in newspapers till today. Here's Barnacle Bill by Gottlieb, fashioned after Popeye. Actually, Barnacle Bill was the anti-hero of a pretty bawdy ballad loosely based on a guy named William Bernard, who was a guy from San Francisco who came out here for the gold rush originally. This is kind of a drunken send-up of Popeye with a can of spinach in his back pocket, and we find him knocking on the door of what apparently is a brothel. Here's a cover of Glamour magazine with a friend of some and foe of others, pre-Hanoi Jane Fonda. Glamour magazine spawned a couple of games. This one spelled G-L-A-M-O-R. The magazine itself was French, which is why you saw the O-U-R spelling. And then the even more overt Glamour by Gottlieb in 1951. Interesting piece, if I have any time left at all. This was a game that was released with a push shoot on it, seven or eight games after the push shoot first appeared on triplets. And the reason being that it kept getting pushed back in the production line because people felt that games that Nyans did subsequent to this were better games. So it was kind of an anachronism. Here we see the first issue of Playboy featuring Marilyn Monroe. Here's how they do it in the licensing era, 1978 Bally Playboy, 1989 Data East Playboy, at 35th anniversary version, 2002 Stern Playboy, and here's how we did it prior to licensing, 1963 Gottlieb Slick Chick. The name came from a restaurant and bar that Wayne Nyans passed on his way home one night when they were looking for a name for this particular game, and that was it. But, of course, they picked up on the bunny ears and the whole nine yards. Another homage to Marilyn Monroe is found here on Domino, Williams 1952, in a Mardi Gras scene. We see the domino or half mask on the jester in the background. Another possible homage to her on Gigi, 1963, shortly after her untimely death. And I think we're kind of winding down here, folks. The manufacturers even went so far as to swipe some of the advertising of major advertisers of the time. This is a Be Happy Go Lucky ad for Lucky Strike, and what do you know? Happy Go Lucky. With the same skater, same theme, and a four-leaf clover on the ice that is as close to a St. Paddy's Day game as Gottlieb ever made. Of course, Shamrock was made by Williams in the mid-50s, so they actually went the whole way. Here's Brooke in tilt. Here's Game Over. I just want to finish with a quote by renowned pinball designer of Party Monsters, Demolition Man, Dr. Dude, and many more, Dennis Nordman, who when asked in a recent Pin Game Journal interview what machine he liked to play best, responded, "I really don't play pinball very much. If I'm at a show, I would say I like to play EM games because I never played a lot of them back in the day. I like the way they look, and I like the nostalgic feel." But I leave it to Edward Rothstein in an article about his visit to the National Pinball Museum, which ran in July in the July 30th New York Times, to bring this presentation full circle. "I like earlier games, the golden age, before the industry felt it had to compete with video games. The logic is clearer. The gameplay straightforward. You know when you win and you know why you win. Sensations are different in the 90s games, the Addams Family or Twilight Zone, which are almost baroquely extravagant with their moving creatures and exotic effects. Sometimes so much is going on, you can even lose track of the ball." I guess in a few simple sentences, they've kind of summed up what the basis of my thesis is. I put this together to encourage those who aren't familiar with the games of the 40s, 50s, and 60s to spend some time playing them here at Expo and to deepen the appreciation of those who already know them and have been captivated by their enduring charms. Finally, I hope to inspire game designers and artists to take a close look at the past as they contemplate pinball's future. Thank you. You've been a great audience, and I've enjoyed presenting. Like to add one final coda, if I could. I know I ran over, and I apologize for that. I'm currently working on a book featuring pinball art from the Golden Age, specifically pinball art of wood rail games. I know many of you have taken photographs of these games, either here or at games that you own at home. If you're interested or willing to share those photographs with me, and if I use them in my book, I will credit you as either the photographer or photographer owner. I'll leave a number of my business cards in this little basket up front. Please feel free to take one if you think you might be interested in doing this. And thank you again for your support.